What I did is I took the data for 1 year of suicides in Japan, and I mapped that onto a piano keyboard.
This is our second time meeting, because I met you at the Masonic Lodge.
That's right.
And it was your 100 and what?
I think it was the 150th.
150th anniversary of that lodge here.
That's right, yeah.
Wow, that was such an event. And I almost thought about joining. And I won't say I won't join yet, but you have some really good people there.
Gordon's
the guy.
Gordon's the guy.
If you haven't met Gordon, you need to meet Gordon. He's on the podcast too. Last name is Campbell, right?
That's right, yeah.
Gordon Campbell. And look through the podcast and you'll meet him. You won't be disappointed. You'll like his podcast. Roy, let me ask you this. Mm. Give me a brief idea of how you grew up,
Sure. Family
and everything.
So I grew up about 2 hours outside of Toronto, Ontario, in Canada. And a bit of a rural experience. And growing up, everybody was the same. They looked all the same and everything. Everyone ate the same food and it was really boring. And you know, my mother's side of the family came from England and Ireland. So every day she's cooking, you know, potatoes as, you know, the main potatoes. Every day is potatoes, right? And so, but I had this desire for something different, right? I've always been interested in different cultures and different people, but at that time, you know, the only access to it was through books or movies and that. So then I went to university in Toronto, the University of Toronto.
Are you the only child?
I have a brother, actually. Sorry, I forgot to mention. Yeah, I have a big brother, but he's a lot older than me. He's 13 years older than me.
Same mother and father.
So when I was 5 years old, he was already 18 and moved out.
So you guys aren't close?
We were for periods, but we're kind of like in different worlds, you know. And but yeah, he's a good guy.
Is he still in Canada?
He is, yeah, he's still in Canada.
And mom and dad, how are they doing?
Well, my father just passed away in October.
Oh, I'm sorry.
End of
that.
September, yeah.
Oh.
And so now it's just my mom and you
how
know.
How old was he when he passed?
He was, I believe, 82.
That's not a bad run then.
Yeah.
Was it because of health issues that he died?
Yeah, he had Parkinson's and he was in the hospital and then...
How long was he in the hospital with Parkinson's?
Well, when he was first diagnosed, they had him there for a few months. And then once he was stabilized, they released him. But then over the next year or two, his condition, you know, deteriorated. And then he went back to the hospital. At that time, when he got like an infection, and that's, he died kind of indirectly, but from an infection in the nursing home.
So this was all in his 80s?
That's right, yeah.
Oh, wow.
So he got diagnosed quite late.
Late,
79,
right.
Yeah, 80, yeah. And, you know, he was a really good father, and he tried to give me all the opportunities that that he never had growing up. So he worked for the civil service, and my mom also worked for the federal government, doing like accounting stuff for the Department of Defense. And I guess they met when they're both in there. And you know, growing up, you know, my dad would take me to whatever soccer lessons or ice hockey and stuff like that, that you know he didn't get a chance to go to, right? But he wanted to help me get an opportunity to go to those things. And you know, when you're young, you don't really appreciate all the effort your dad and mom does for you. And I honestly didn't really, you know, appreciate all the effort that they put in to me until probably actually like in my early 30s, right? I'm 40 now, so I would say 30.
Are you married now?
No.
Not married too soon? That's why you look so happy. You're not married, isn't it?
Perhaps one day. But yeah, and you know, I realized, you know, all that effort and all that hardship, and you know, sometimes you just don't realize it until it's too late. So,
yeah, seemed like it.
But
I'm sure you got a chance to let
her. I did.
Knows, yeah,
I did.
That's good.
Yeah,
that's
I was
good.
Very.
Were
lucky.
You there? Were you there with him when he passed?
I was. Yeah.
Oh. Wow.
Just by myself with him in the hospital. I actually was very lucky to get. I flew back immediately. I booked a ticket the morning I heard the news that the doctors thought he was going to pass, and I didn't, you know, get to the hospital till like 2 a.m. And actually, my brother and mother were there already, like all day, many days, and they're really tired. So they went home to take a rest, and then I went from the hotel in a taxi there, and it was just me and my father. And then, like literally 20 minutes after I arrived, he passed. It's like he was waiting, right, for me.
You gotta be kidding me.
That's what happened. Man. Yeah, true story. So I was just in the nick of time, 20 minutes there, and he was, you know,
he was lucid. He was lucid and able.
Not conscious, but he was alive, and I would like to think that he
knew
felt.
You were
there. I would like to think that because it is oddly, you know, the timing was odd that he passed us 20 minutes after
you came. Yeah. Right. So then you call your mother. And
sure.
Your brother,
yeah.
They came over,
and everything happened after.
But
that.
But your mother, how's your mother doing now?
It's a struggle.
I don't think so because she spent all her. Yeah.
Yeah. So they were. It's kind of my mother and my father, they really lived kind of in their own world. They didn't have a lot of friends outside of work or bringing them into their, you know, personal life. So my mom doesn't really have a strong support network, I think. So it's.
Is your brother living close by?
He is, but.
Is he married with family?
I believe he's engaged now.
Okay.
Married, but
you guys wait a long. Did your father wait late to get married too?
He got. Man, I'm thinking now, I was 26, so my dad must have been. Yeah, I think my father was 28, yeah.
Well, that was late for his time. Late for my time. I got married when I was 33.
Okay.
And that was late, because everybody I knew was getting married right out of high school to get into college, or as soon as they finished college, 21.
Really, yeah.
So they were getting married early. Mm. Yeah. Wow.
I think I'll wait a little bit more, but you know, maybe one day. I'm not saying it's out of the cards, but perhaps one day. So,
So go on. So college, and what'd you do for
You know, I went to the University of Toronto, which is it's kind of like Canada's version of Harvard, but not as, you know, maybe fancy. And you know, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. At first, I was really interested in politics, studying about it, but I got very disillusioned with it after reading about it, right? And so I kind of didn't really want to be a part of that world at that time. But I was still, you know, in the back of my head, really interested in different cultures and stuff like that. So I double majored in anthropology and philosophy. And and that's kind of like when I started getting interested a little bit in Japan, was through the anthropology.
Okay. And how so? How did that get you interested in Japan? Because of its long history?
So. Actually, in one of the courses I studied, we studied the Aboriginal people of Japan, the Ainu up in Hokkaido, right? And, you know, I was doing an essay on it, and I was very interested. And I actually, one winter break, I went there to visit, you know, because at the time I was actually dating a Japanese girl. And it kind of all, coalesced. And then I visited Hokkaido and went around there. And
what year was that?
That was maybe... when I was maybe 21 or 20, so around 2001 or 2002.
Okay.
And so it was a good experience. Mm-hmm. And I lost my interest in the Aboriginal world of Japan. And I came back to, I graduated and I was working as an editor of history books at the time. But, you know, my passion at that time was music, right? And music had always been a passion of mine since, you know, my parents got me this, like, little cheap Casio synthesizer when I was, like, really, really small, like 10. But I was, you know, then picking up, you know, guitar when I was around 13. But I was really interested in, you know, there's a revolution going on around the early 2000s that, you know, democratized recording technology and electronic music production for anyone, right? You could, you know, just spend under $100 for software and be able to produce almost studio quality. Oh. Now definitely studio quality, right?
And on your iPhone.
Yeah, exactly. You can definitely do that. So it's really ramped up. And I was really interested in synthesizers at the time and making like glitchy, unique sounds, because I thought this is just, you know, again, it was that theme in my life of being attracted to something that's different or strange, or, well, you could say strange or unique or unusual.
But wasn't that in one of the movies with Flashdance or one of them, they had the kid, they were doing that.
With the knobs, they're tweaking it,
They were tweaking it, but not just that, they had it up on top of the car and he did synthesized
music.
And I think they went to the School of Performing Arts.
Okay.
Those were the students. I forget the name of the movie. And then his father was so proud of his son because he made all the synthesized music.
But you can make, the amazing part is you can make sounds that no one's ever heard of before. Truly unique sounds. It's like making your own instrument. I mean, it still's got the same scale, but the sounds are totally unique, right? So that was like, it's kind of like my passion, right? But the thing is, you can't really turn that into a career unless you're, you know, at the right place in the right time and know the right people. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of things that go into that. And I wasn't interested in pop music and stuff like that. I was more interested in experimental music. Mm-hmm. And you're not going to make a living doing that. So, you know, I graduated. And then because at the time I was, you know, dating a Japanese girl, so I wanted to come to Japan, right? It was the next logical step.
But you'd already been here once.
I had, yeah, so there was...
Okay.
So
how long were you here when you came that one time?
Just a couple of weeks, yeah.
Okay.
And now...
And this is just on your own volition, just...
Yes.
You wanted to, and did you go up to Hokkaido? To see the Ainu?
Yes, I did, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So you saw the Japanese that have hair on their chest. And
yeah, that's right, yeah, yeah. And then I came back a few years later, right? And, yeah, it's been 13 years. I've been living here full time since then. So, you know, the first thing is when I graduated, I'm like, how do I get into Japan, right? I needed a visa, right? So at the time, you know, I was, when I first graduated, I was working as an editor of history books, right? And, you know, it was very difficult to get into Japan. So I figured the easiest way to get in there was to teach English. So I did that, as so many people do, just to get the visa. I can change it and look for another job once I got there. So at the time when I got here, I was still, you know, learning about, you know, electronics and music and stuff like that. And one of the things that was really strange for me was, you know, when I first got here, the trains are stopping all the time, right? And you know, suicide's a bit of an issue in Japan, right? And whereas, you know, back home or in Canada, at least, it's a, kind of like a taboo thing. People don't really talk about it. If it happens, there's no, like, articles saying this person did that. Well, at least in 20 years ago, they didn't write about it in the newspaper, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe about the issue, but they wouldn't, you know, identify individuals. It was still kind of taboo. So at that time, I was learning a software called Pure Data. And what it allowed you to do is... take kind of signals and you could change them into data, and then you could then map that into different kind of synthesizers or anything. So what I did is I took the data for 1 year of suicides in Japan, and I mapped that onto a piano keyboard, and I created a software program within Pure Data. You create these things called patches, and it would randomly trigger a number that represented the number of suicides in a prefecture, right? It's a little bit morbid, okay. Right? So basically you have, let's say there was, I don't know, like 50 suicides in Tokyo in January.
Is there any video? Was it a video? Was it connected to something visual?
It could be, but this time it was only audio.
It was audio, so you just see the spike. You could hear the sounds. Okay.
Yeah,
you can see it in audio, you can see the spikes, but you'd hear the sound.
Yes.
And it'd be a distinct sound time something happened.
So for example, if there was 50 suicides in the month of January in Tokyo, it would play the note number 50.
Okay.
Right? But of course, you know, some places the number's so higher, so I had to divide all the numbers so they would fit on a piano keyboard, or most of them.
All right.
And I did this, and I thought it was really cool. And then I was like, well, how do I get this out there, right? So I emailed some editors of different, you know, magazines and that, and it got picked up in Wired magazine in England.
What year was this?
This was 2013.
Okay.
And I was like, kind of like my first taste of press. I was like, oh my God, wow, this is so cool, right? And so, you know, Wired, the technology magazine, interviewed me on that, and then...
They came here to interview you?
No, it was all on the phone.
On the phone,
at that
interviewed
time,
you.
Yeah.
Okay. Was this also just only audible? Only
yes,
audio?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
So, and of course, I you know, uploaded it and gave... there was a copy on Spotify. At that time, SoundCloud.
So people could hear the interview.
Yeah, yeah.
How long was the interview?
It was just like a 30-minute interview, it was a written article that they wrote, right? The old-style press, right? This is probably... Yeah, I don't know if podcasts were just starting to take off.
How did they title it? What was the title of it?
What was it? actually forget the title.
Because it was after, because like you said, it is somewhat morbid.
Yeah, yeah. So they
talk about
to spend
that. But
it,
I was wondering what kind of title they put on it. Japan Suicide Put to Music.
Something
or something
like that.
Is that right?
Yeah. It was the idea of why they were interested in it is because at the time they were interested in big data was like the new thing around 2013. And the idea of sonifying random data was interesting to people at that time, right? So, you know, at the time there was someone at NASA who sonified or took the data of, I believe, some telemetry data of Saturn or some space data and over a black hole and made it into music, right? And I thought, well, I know the process how to do that. So I did it with some sort of, catchy an interesting topic that would, you know, while morbid, it still would create attention.
Get it, yeah. Right.
So anyways, that led to that. And then I think I got a few more interviews at like with Vice Media and some other stuff. And so I thought, you know, and I'm still, you know, teaching English at that time. Okay. But then I'm thinking, how do I capitalize on this? What else can I do, right?
Right.
So I then learned a little bit more about different sensors and how to connect them to the computer. And I made various different projects, including like a radiation detector that would make music out of the radiation detector. And this is, you know, after Fukushima, right? So it was also newsworthy, right? And that got some press. And then I made a lie detector machine that you could, you know, put on two people's fingers. And it was like the sensor was called a galvanic skin response, and it the resistance changes based on how much you sweat, right? And that would change, that resistance would change the value that the computer would read. And if it was, for example, just like a 10, the value, for example, then it would play like note 10 in a unique way. So I did that with that, and two people were being interviewed, and it would like kind of like create a unique composition amongst two people, right? And so I thought, you know, what if people experienced different things in life, not just through reading it, but what if we could experience it in a totally different way through making it into sound, right? How would we experience truth and lies or trauma? Would we experience it in a different way rather than if we just read about it?
Yes.
And yeah, so around that time, I got invited to give a lecture in Iceland to their graduate students on, I think it was a class on technology and music and how it came together. So yeah, it was really fun. And then I spoke in Norway at a place.
Wait. But you were still teaching English at that time?
Yeah.
So you took off from your English job
and went
to Iceland. And
yes.
How long were you there?
Just for one lecture, yeah. I was there for a week, and then...
They flew you there?
They did. They paid for it. Yeah, yeah. So it was pretty good. And then...
And your first time being in Iceland?
Loved it. It was really great. And, you know, I made the most out of that trip, though. I got to also do something similar in Norway. They have, it's kind of like the Norwegian Center for Technology and Music, and I give a talk there. So I come back to Japan after this, right? And I'm like, well, I can't make a living with weirdo experimental music, right? And, you know, it was really frustrating for me because I was getting some sort of traction, right? In media and getting invited to places, but I can't pay rent with that. I could, you know, go on these trips, but can't make rent, and I'm still an English teacher at that time. So it's really frustrating for me, right? Because, you know, you want to build a career, make yourself. And the only way to make a career with kind of that experimental electronic music is probably to go in as a professor and then, you know, do like a PhD in some sort of like a technology and music program somewhere. And at that time, that wasn't really appealing to me because it's, you know, a very long process. And so I realized at that point is I have to change my career, right? And I said, I don't want to be an English teacher.
How long had you been in Japan?
Yeah, for like maybe around 5 years.
5 years, okay. So you're 5 years in now.
So I started learning visual art stuff. I was very, you know, late to the game with that, and I never studied visual art, and I'm actually really horrible at drawing still. But I had to find a way to monetize creativity that was a process that any reasonable person could do, right? Because you know, it's very, like I said, super difficult to monetize music, especially nowadays with Spotify and that, and your artists are getting like 1 cent of stream. And you know, user experience was becoming very popular at the time, and I realized, well, this is something I can do, right? And now, for your listeners, if they don't know what user experience design is, it's like, imagine, well, there's a lot of different analogies to explain what it is, but one way to explain it is that, like, you know, it's like an architect that builds a digital product, but also we focus on someone's experience inside of that digital product. For example, how do they navigate the certain sections? How do they feel when they're using it? So what naturally makes sense? So for example, like if you go to a grocery store back home, where is usually the milk? Where they put the milk? Do they put it in the front of the store?
No, put it in the back. It's always right. In the back, because you know you have to go in the back, right? So they guide you through that. They also put up little items that you would never think to buy right by the register.
Yes. And that's exactly the same thing that a user experience designer does for a digital product. It's the same thing.
So once you start with that, you can be led audibly through different corridors that you may not necessarily think of.
Or just the visual design.
These are visual.
This is all visual.
Okay, same thing.
I had to get out of the audio game and totally go for the visual thing. At the time, I was teaching English at a public company called CrowdWorks, and that was kind of like my first taste of a tech company. And then from there, I got a mentor in UX design, and then I got some opportunities to practice that, and I took a course online, and I started learning about that. But at the same time, I was also learning like video special effects. I don't know if you probably heard of the software After Effects
from
Adobe. Yeah, and I was really interested in that, right? So at the same time, I was learning that. So I had the mentor in the UX and UI, right? Designing the buttons and what the layout looks like of software for the user interface, and then the user experience. And there, in any mid-sized company, that job is kind of together. Okay. It's only in big companies like at Google where they will separate the user experience and the user interface. So I was learning the After Effects on the side as well, because remember, my goal was to get more visual tool sets so that I can create more output. So at that time, there was a prize for this fashion company called DKNY, right? Donna Karan, New York, and maybe not as popular these days, but I was like, I'm going to try it, right? Because it's free to enter, right? So I made kind of this, they were rebranding, and they wanted people to make like kind of a animated commercial or an animated logo. So I created like a very vivid, random, crazy colors, and you know, I submitted it and I won that, right? And I was really, you know, again, remember, I never took art classes in high school or university or anything, right? So I was really happy to win that. And then I started doing, you know, more visual art in that. And this is when I started applying to all these tech companies, and you know, it's been history ever since that. Yeah. And
so what were you doing to make money though? You didn't go through that because you stopped teaching English.
That's right. Yeah. So I was able to transfer at the company that I was working at. So it was a private tech. A public tech company.
Right.
And I was teaching English there, and I found a mentor. And because I was teaching English to the executives of the company, you know, I had like a way to transfer my job, right? Or to get a taste of doing something different, because I knew the decision makers, right? And I could say, hey, I've been learning this. Can I, you know, help the team out a little bit? And they said, sure, right? And
so you're still with them now?
No, I've changed companies since then. Okay. But then, you know, at first it was like 50-50 doing English and then working UX, and eventually full-time UX there. And then I just changed different companies, and then it's been doing, yeah.
So what do you do now?
Now I work at a company called Masrika, and it's like a, kind of the Japan's version of Salesforce.
Okay.
And
how long have you been with them?
I've been with them for over a year now, and basically I am designing the user interface and the experience of what it's like to use their software. And I'm, you know, a member of a team. It's not just me, a team that works on it.
How many people?
Yeah, it's a 4-member team.
And okay, are they all Japanese but you?
Yeah, I'm the only person from North America in the company.
So they're speaking in Japanese?
Yes.
Then? So you have to speak Japanese.
That's right, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So the one, is it all men?
It's split, yeah. Our team is two girls, women.
Two guys.
Yeah.
Okay.
Actually, three women and two men, yeah.
So. Are you guys, so it's five of you. Are they all around the same age as you?
Yeah, about that. Really? I'm closer to the oldest one, but we're not like early 20s, just graduated. No, we're like around
you're seasoned. And everybody's been with other companies.
Yeah, that's right. They're right. They're all mid-career.
They're mid-career, or what they say
in Japan, mid-career.
Right, mid-career, yeah. So you're still looking for your niche.
Yeah.
So what is it like working with them? Is it pretty, how do you find it compared to what you've done before?
So it's a challenge. So actually currently I'm also working for an American company.
You're doing two companies?
Yes.
But you're working on software. You're working on the face of the software
interface.
Interface, okay.
And so I'm working for a Web3 company in America that is interested in kind of the whole cryptocurrency space. And working in America with an American company compared to working with a Japanese company is totally night and day.
In what way? What
do you think? In so many ways.
Give me a few of the biggest ways.
Sure. So in America, or with an American company, I have so much freedom to do any sort of design I want.
You're giving more autonomy.
And they do not care about small little errors or details, right? Like if something's one pixel off or something like that, right? Okay. Whereas in Japan, it's less about the idea and it's about the presentation of it, right? So like everything, like the most smallest detail is super focused on it. Whereas the American companies know, like, we got to get to market, push it out, we'll fix it later. Whereas in Japan, they'll wait months and months and months or years before something is pushed out the door, right? And then they lose their advantage in being the first out the door, right?
But their product is, when it does come out the door, there's no, I mean, it works.
It works.
And it works perfectly. Probably,
maybe,
right?
Yeah.
Or more than the others. But in this,
or it could be too late to that.
I know what you're saying. I think, but in that field, when you're talking about technology, because so much is being churned out, you don't have time to look at the small things.
Yeah.
Get it out and fix it afterwards.
Yeah.
But Japan's so risk adverse.
Yes.
They will not, I mean, they will jump in. That's why they jump in front of trains.
Right, yeah.
You know, a failure is a failure.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean,
so it's there are a lot of positives about working in Japan, of course, like it's very secure, and it's more, responsibility is more shared amongst the team, right? So if I make a mistake, it's not the end of the day. But if I make a mistake in the American company, it's like, you're gone, right? That's it. Maybe they'll give you a few chances, but
okay,
you know what I mean?
It's different, right? No, because you're part of the team, and nobody fails here. I mean, you stay together.
Right.
And they will cover your back.
That's right, but, you know.
That's right. In the States,
no.
It's on you.
Right,
now
right.
It's on you.
It's all in the final output.
We'll give you autonomy, but if you mess up, you're out of here.
That's right. And so there's
give and takes.
There's, yes. So it's really interesting experiencing the difference, too. And, you know, hierarchy is a whole thing, you know, with, like,
that's
in
right.
Japan with the bosses and the managers. And whereas in, especially, I guess, in the tech world in America, that's not so much the case. Perhaps only, I'm guessing, just in maybe the tech world, but I don't know. Maybe in general, right? Like, it's you can just approach the, you know, CEO, or it's no big deal.
They usually have open door policies in the U.S.
Yeah.
where you can go to the top person and tell them, you know, what you're concerned about.
Yeah.
But then you'll still have to go through the hierarchy, but still, you have his ear.
Yes.
Whereas here, how dare you? You're fired for doing that.
Right, so it's a totally different experience. And
that's right.
So, you know, late at night, I work with doing the American company stuff, and then also on the weekends and that. And then, of course, during the day in Japan. And I get to see the very stark contrast, eh? And I think to myself, it's like, that's why, you know, blah, 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 or that's why that. And I mean, it's good and bad on both sides, right? So, yeah, I don't know. I feel torn, like, whether, you know,
you think
if
you
I
might
ever
go back? You think you might go back to Canada?
See,
or do you think you'll
the thing
stay?
Is, you know, there's so much opportunity in the West, and it's all about what you said about the Japanese being risk averse, right? So, like, it's very, like, let's say if I wanted to start my own tech company in Japan, it's just super difficult to raise funding, venture capital funding, right? It's because they don't want to take a risk on anything. So unless it's a business model that has proven itself, for example, like, you know, if you can say this is, you know, Uber, like Uber, then they're like, okay, this works in America, we can do it, right? But if it's like a totally new idea, no, it's not going to get funded.
I would challenge that idea this okay. way only, saying this, that because you're a foreigner, mm-hmm. you have more opportunities here than you could ever imagine.
Interesting.
And they would let you do it because it's not a Japanese family.
Mm-hmm. It's a foreign, it's a, yeah. I can see that.
And they would give you the funding. This
really?
Is the C.
Interesting.
Yeah. Why wouldn't they? Because you're not Japanese.
Right.
And they know that you've been educated differently. Mm-hmm. You've been educated to be creative. Mm. Japanese aren't. Mm. They've been educated to do what they're told to do. Very militaristic.
Yes.
Very much so.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
it has its place
it
in
does.
The world. But if it's about the field that you're in now,
yeah.
you can run the show. You can say this was going to take, and they'll say, "All right, we'll do it."
So that's interesting.
I would think.
Yeah, that is something.
But only because you're a foreigner. Mm-hmm. Now, some Japanese trying to do it. No, you're being rebellious. Mm-hmm. You should get in place. Yeah. You're the nail sticking out.
Mm-hmm. You're gone.
You're
going to
get no.
Yeah.
You're supposed to be wadi wadi.
Right. Yeah.
The
together,
team.
Yeah.
But you don't have to be.
So what I realize though is, you know, a lot of people are like, is it this or that, right? And I realize it doesn't have to be like that, right? So I think, you know, the best solution, you know, I think, there, like you said, there is a place for the Japanese style of doing things. And there's also a place for the Western. It doesn't have to be that one or the other. So I was thinking, wouldn't it be best to create like a team of both that both do what they do best in their own way? So, you know, if you want, you need that detail for you know, some aspects before you produce a product, right? But you also need the creativity in the West. And if you bring the both together, wouldn't you get like a really great product, right?
Sounds to me like you got a pitch stick, a winning pitch, man. You should go with it.
Because
think about it. Everything that we have, everything that man has out here that's been created, was at one time what? An idea. Mm. And ideas cost you nothing. Mm. And you were trained to come up with ideas. Mm. They would love to do it. And you're building their confidence and their trust already because you're working with them and you're saying, okay, I'll do it that way. Mm. However, what if we do it this way? Mm. You're learning techniques now. Mm. I think this is the best business school on the planet. Before I end, Roy, there's a question I'd like to ask everyone. With all the knowledge you have now, if you could take that knowledge and go back in time and speak to the younger Roy, what would you tell him and how old would you be?
So honestly, like, it took me a long time in my life to find my place, and I think for a very long time I was very selfish and focused on myself, and as soon as I changed that focus into trying to help someone else, everything else changed in my life. As soon as you figure out how can I help somebody, right? And it's not just about, you know, charity or something like that. It's not like that. It's just like, how can you help someone achieve their goal or they have their projects? And if you can help them, you're going to end up improving your life. Right? So I think truly that's the most important piece of advice I'd give myself if I could go back in time. Because I found out that way too late in the game.
You'd be a very lucky man by doing it.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
I want to thank all of you for watching or listening to this podcast. And never forget, it's all on loan, so continue to reach for the stars.
Because you're too blessed to be stressed. Mm-hmm.